You are listening to the podcast of Called to Communion. More podcasts and other information can be found at www.calledtocommunion.com. Welcome to the Call to Communion podcast. This is episode number one, sort of a pilot episode, and I'm Tim Troutman, former PCA myself. I was received into the Catholic Church 2 years ago. And with me today is Dr. Jonathan Dean, who I will be interviewing, and just to get some insight about his conversion to the Catholic Church. He originally started out in Calvary Chapel in Southern California, and he moved around PCA and OPC, so he has some experience there. So he's also one of the contributors at Called to Communion, so you'll see him around. And Dr. Dean holds his PhD in molecular biology, and he is a father of three, and has two sons, one daughter, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And he also lives with his wife in, I think I mentioned, Southern California. So, well, welcome to the show, and glad to have you here.
And glad to be here to share my story that might be interesting to some.
Absolutely. So, is there anything else... sort of a background that I missed? Anything else important for us to know about you?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess just to clarify, I became a Christian through the ministry of Calvary Chapel in about almost 15 years ago. I spent about 6 years there, and then I joined the OPC in 2000. And then in 2006, I left the OPC and went to the PCA. And then just a little more than 2 years later, I became Catholic.
Okay, so about 7 years between OPC and PCA, is that right?
Yeah.
About the time frame. Okay. Well, that's interesting. I visited OPC just briefly, but I've pretty much stayed in PCA my whole life. Was there a theological reason for you moving from OPC to PCA?
In a sense, there was. So you know, after understanding certain issues about Calvary Chapel that I came to disagree with, such as the idea that the world was going to end any second, and certain benchmarks were put up as this is going to happen, and then the world will end, or the rapture, of course, is what I mean, not the world ending. When those benchmarks never came to pass, I started doubted the whole structure of what's called dispensationalist premillennial eschatology, and sort of found a home in becoming Reformed. Though I didn't like Calvinism initially, and so in being in the OPC, it was great that there was this interest in study, but what I found myself doing was sort of narrowing my field of those that I would call good Christians. But at the same time, all my friends that went to Calvary Chapel, many of them also left, but they ended up in many various different destinations from just OPC. Some were Reformed Baptists, some were Emergent Church proponents, others went into just mainline Christian denominations. And I sort of realized that, you know, the church needed to be larger than just those who agreed with me theologically. And from my experience, going into the PCA was a sort of more of a, not ecumenical in a strict sense, but more broadly minded about who we can sort of say are great Christians. And There are people like that in the OPC who have that appreciation, but I had a general feel that in the PCA, like, you know, our church bulletins would not only have quotes from J. Gresham Machen. Actually, there were quotes from Mother Teresa and G.K. Chesterton, and at the time I was thinking, why are these Catholics in our church bulletin? But at the same time, the overall feel of joining the PCA was sort of wanting to embrace all of God's people, wanting that prayer that we would all be one. As Christ and the Father are one, we wanted that. I think they have more of an emphasis on getting that, trying to make that come true.
What was your general attitude towards Catholicism?
I guess to answer that, there's sort of two interesting experiences about being Catholic, or thinking of other people who are Catholic. I remember just becoming received into the OPC. I was given a great copy of the Scottish version. The, you know, 1648 version of the Westminster Confession of Faith, and just sort of really reading it cover to cover and going over different points with my wife, and we would go to my in-laws' house, who still went to this, who still to this day actually go to the Calvary Chapel. And my mother-in-law asked me, well, what's that book? And I said, oh, it's our Confession of Faith, which contains our, you know, shorter and larger catechism. And she said, catechism? That's something that Catholics do. Are you making my daughter become Catholic? And I was just completely infuriated. I thought, no, you don't understand. You semi-Pelagians and Arminianism are actually those who are closer to Catholicism, given Catholicism's, you know, lack of, you know, giving God glory and things like that. And a similar charge was leveled by the writer Dave Hunt, who debated over the issue of Calvinism with the Reformed Baptist writer James White.
Right.
Dave Hunt actually accused James White of being an all-Calvinist by being kind of sort of friendly to Catholics by the fact that if you read the Institutes of Christian Religion by John Calvin, you're going to see a lot of quotations of St. Augustine and other church fathers. Mm-hmm. And James White, I'm sure, was just as angry as I was at the time, because if you know about James White, he writes quite a bit about all the evils of Catholicism as well as Arminians. And so at the time, I just thought, you know, becoming Reformed was moving furthest possible away from becoming, thinking like a Catholic. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, that was, you know, sort of a philosophical difference that I had, was that, you know, Catholics sort of give themselves and various saints and processes glory that is really due to God alone. And on the sort of human experience side, I just, as far as Catholicism goes, I just didn't really know many people who were devout Catholics.
When did you first start entertaining the possibility that the Catholic Church might actually be correct about her claims?
Well, as I was saying, I hadn't met many devout Catholics. And what happened was, essentially, I started meeting those who were either devout Catholics or those who were on their way. One of the contributors to Call to Communion, Brian Cross, he and I and some others online were discussing some philosophical issues that really challenged my views as a Presbyterian who subscribed to what's called presuppositional apologetics. I was hearing about what Thomas Aquinas had said in some of his challenges, and it was, you know, without getting into the details, it was very interesting to hear these great, you know, whether they're true or not, they were quite well thought out arguments about the nature of reality and of substance and things like that. And, you know, in addition to that, there was a sort of historical issue that I was facing in the same area of apologetics, but it ended up reaching to everything, including the papacy, and church government, the nature of the canon, all these things. I was thinking about history. I had a class on apologetics, on presuppositionalist apologetics, and I proposed writing an essay on the way in which you can see throughout all the church fathers, beginning with Justin Martyr, you know, and Eusebius and Augustine, Tertullian, etc., seeing how those individuals were actually at least proto-presuppositionalists, to see the seeds of presuppositionalism in them. And my teacher said something that really struck me, which was basically, don't waste your time with the church fathers. You're not going to find it there. It was sort of really only brought about in the later times through good reform guys. And I just thought to myself, well, does that mean that, you know, Augustine wasn't a, you know, he wouldn't go to a PCA if he were alive today, you know? And it's funny because that's sort of the way many people take for granted, that whatever church they go to is where the great Christian saints would be going. And one of the people who was interacting with Catholics and along these issues of God and proving his existence was a guy named Francis Beckwith. And Francis Beckwith was the president of the Evangelical Theological Society. He wasn't Reformed, but he was sort of friendly to Reformed people, as well as people in Calvary Chapel. So I'd heard about him before I became Reformed and after. And as it turns out, he actually is a revert to Catholicism in 2007. So when he converted or reverted, I finally got around to actually reading arguments about Catholicism. Mm-hmm. I had them, you know, online with friends, and one of those friends, who's now my godfather, he had bought me a book, and I just had left it on my bookshelf. It's called The Spirit and Forms of Protestantism by Louis Bouyer. And I actually opened it like in the late spring of 2007. And after really giving Catholicism a good chance, I was very challenged. Yeah.
And this is you read that in 07?
Yeah.
So I guess, would you say the spring of 07 was really when you first started to really consider that it might be true?
I started debating about these issues of St. Thomas and Cornelius Van Til in 2003, and it was just a growing amount of maybe there's a chance these guys are right, but it was really low. I mean, and I should say once I read Spirit and Forms of Louis Bouilhet, I pretty much felt like I was in a full Nelson, and I had no way of getting out of it.
So the roots kind of go a little bit deeper, but it took a little bit to spring up, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, when I wanted to write that Justin Martyr paper, this was the summer of 2001, and it was a very uncomfortable experience to sort of say to myself that, yes, all of church history has sort of gone a different way from what I heard. And that's one of the things that Brian Cross once said to me was, you know, as a Protestant and even today, a lot of times, if he ever encountered someone like a Mormon, just sort of prima facie saying, yeah, there's this premise that, you know, this is Joseph Smith and the church was wrong from, you know, Christ's resurrection till the 1800s. And somehow magically everything got right again through Joseph Smith. But everybody up until the 1800s was wrong. That criticism against Mormonism to me is still very interesting. And I used it as a Protestant. Mm-hmm. But what I realized was the same criticism could go with Protestantism. You know, the overall idea that this structure of a sort of ultimately invisible church is you know, in sola scriptura and all those other issues, they're sort of not there until the time of Luther, or even some of that is even after Luther.
So you started in 2007, you really started coming to the conclusion that there's really something substantial here in the Catholic Church. But surely, even at that point, you still had some theological hurdles to overcome. What were those?
I think the key issue for me to deal with was just sort of the claims of the church. The church saying that, you know, Jesus had established a visible entity that was identifiable through a connection through apostles. I've heard many say that, you know, that just is a romantic notion that's too good to be true. And I shared those sentiments. And so I you know, at the time, I just started going to Mass, and I started, you know, just looking through different claims about various things that perhaps are proof of errors of the Pope, you know, because if the church is not who she says she is, then there's, you know, there's 2,000 years of church history to go and evaluate things. And I found that the things that are supposedly the biggest flaws of popes, for example, Pope Honorius, in not condemning a certain heresy, he was, you know, showing himself to be a bad pope, or whether they were licentious. I realized that none of those things touched the issues of what Catholics teach about papal infallibility. And, you know, because the church doesn't teach that the popes say the best things. It's more of a matter of does the church teach theological errors or moral errors? Mm. And in not suppressing a heresy, you're not teaching an error. It's more of a sin of omission. But the gift given to the apostles was never said to be, you know, this magical world where everything is perfect. I mean, anyone who has lived more than 3 seconds can tell you that it's not the way the world is. But within the claims of what the church says, it's amazing that you can actually study other churches and see how only the Catholic Church has had that sort of rock-like stability. The Eastern Orthodox at times would be iconoclasts. And right. Every mainline Protestant denomination today is in one way or the other infected by liberalism, to the point where we have all these offshoots. You know, Presbyterians being in the OPC and the PCA, we were sort of retreating from the liberalism that, you know, J. Gresham Machen and others fought against. And on the flip side, whereas you had some you know, rogue bishops and rogue priests, you don't find rogue popes, you know, sort of putting the stamp on liberalism or the stamp on Arianism. And that really just confirmed to me that what the church's claim had about itself was actually historically substantiated. And everything else sort of fell into pieces there about whether it's accurate that purgatory is spoken of in various parables and parts of 1 Corinthians. And of course, if you know the canon, then you can actually include the stories in Maccabees about offerings for the dead. And all those things, you know, they're sort of anchored by this principle that there is a church that was established by Jesus.
How about, it seems to me, and maybe this is just my experience, but it seems to me when I talk to Reformed, Mariology seems to be a big issue, even more so than, say, you know, someone who's a Baptist or something like that. Was that a big issue for you, Mariology?
Well, every issue, including purgatory and Mary, were sort of seeing things through the Catholic lens. And so what I understood in actually reading statements from the catechisms and Vatican II and statements on, you know, her assumption, these dogmas are not viewed in the same way that Reformed people look at them. It's a completely different perspective. The perspective I have now as a Catholic is not that Mary is, you know, the fourth person of the Trinity or something odd like that. It's more of a matter of seeing God's grace potentiated and actualized in an individual, and seeing Mary as a sort of first fruit of Jesus's great redemption, and seeing that, you know, we are to sort of model ourselves after her. And that's a different story from sort of like, you know, Jesus can't really handle this prayer, so that's why you're saying the Hail Mary. The Hail Mary and Rosary and other sorts of Marian devotions, I now understand them through the Catholic eye of being actually just a sort of gratitude to God for having redeemed men. And she's just happens to be the first one. But at the same time, she's also the Theotokos, the God-bearer, as the Greek scholar. And at the same time, also, some of the things were just historical questions, because I actually didn't understand that, you know, for example, that, you know, Calvin thought that, you know, Mary was a perpetually, you know, a virgin. So realizing that sort of we're not stealing God's glory in seeing glory was a big issue.
It seems to me like theological issues are one thing, but then I know a lot of people who have or have had other issues, non-theological issues, and that can be sort of a whole different ball game. And I didn't have any of those, so it's hard for me to, I guess, fully appreciate it. But did you have any issues you would say were non-theological?
Yeah, in a sense, I did, because, you know, in spending these years with fellowshipping, you know, and respecting Christians that are not Catholic, and then basically saying, I'm called to be Catholic, and I think in a sense we all are. But just ultimately, I knew that I was going to be leaving certain things that I had enjoyed doing, and my family had enjoyed doing. You know, all the groups of you know, youth group or you know, family Bible studies, things like that. I knew it wasn't going to be the same anymore. And I know that, of course, there are great Catholic groups that you can spend time together, but it's just a different culture. But you know, the more I attended Mass before I converted, the more I was excited about it. It was a different mentality of, you know, this is we're coming here to, you know, remember what Christ did, and to have the priest, you know, keep the ongoing grace of God right before our eyes, literally. And once I had that sort of understanding of why we go to church and what is happening at church, I was less fearful.
The East, it's always a hot topic, especially for potential converts. I don't think I've ever spoken with any convert to the Catholic Church who didn't also consider Eastern Orthodoxy at the time. Did you consider the East, and if so, why did you choose Rome instead of Constantinople, so to speak?
Yeah, I have a good friend of a friend. We've spoken several times. He did the exact same thing as me, in the sense that he went from Calvary Chapel to being in the PCA, and he is now Eastern Orthodox. And of course, there's, you know, Francis Schaeffer's son has left Presbyterian evangelical world to be Eastern Orthodox, and it sounded interesting to me. And definitely with the issue of just did Christ establish a visible church, I came to a point where logically Anglicanism, Eastern Orthodoxy, and Catholicism were options, but Anglicanism never struck me as that appealing, given all the things going on right now at the Lambeth Conference. But with Eastern Orthodoxy, it sounded plausible to an extent. And you know, I had one friend who said he was not going to convert. As it turned out, he became confirmed the day after I did. But for a time, he was very close to Eastern Orthodoxy, going to their liturgies, and the guy who mutually sponsored us, recommended a book to me called The Russian Church and the Papacy by a guy named Vladimir Soloviev. And it was very fascinating to read a Russian Orthodox person's perspective on the papacy. And in there, there's a lot of things interesting in that book, but the most compelling element of it was a historical event called the Robert Council, where essentially in the year 449, a heresy was won the conciliar vote, but the only thing stopping it was Rome. Rome right. said, "Contradictor, it is contradicted," and only if there was some sort of, you know, power which has the right to veto, even if it did not have the majority. This is the only thing that stopped us as a body of Christians from advocating heresy. And you know, the council most people know from the 400s is Chalcedon, and with Chalcedon, you know, that was 2 years later, but you know, that was just as conciliar as 449. So just understanding that you needed to have Rome as there as a veto, otherwise you'd have all these heresies. And he goes into not just 449 but also iconoclasm. That is the only thing that really provided a rock, and he argues that Peter is the rock, and he quotes, you know, doctors of the Eastern churches and shows that those guys believed the same thing as Catholics believed, but post, you know, 1054 they started denying it. And so historically, again, I saw that there was precedent for Peter as the rock in principle and then in action.
Jonathan, what would you say is, if you could pick one reason and just say that this or this reason in particular was what really convinced you of the Catholic Church's claim, what would that issue be?
Yeah, that's it's a hard one to answer, but I guess the real thing that struck me in every debate that has happened between the Church and Protestantism, or you know, in the early, you know, pre-Reformation days, that the Catholic Church has always had a sort of solution that is not only true, but it sort of makes my view of the world holistic. I guess what I mean by holistic is, you know, there are times in which I've appreciated this element of my brethren who are Pentecostal. You know, they have this passion that's emotional. But then there's other times where you see, you know, not enough intellectualism. And I find that, and I enjoyed that greatly, being a scientist. I enjoyed that greatly, you know, in the Reform circles, but it wasn't there. And there are other elements about being sort of, you know, enjoying life, you know, being this jolly sort of Franciscan friar. You find that within Catholicism, as well as the asceticism aspect of you know, selling all you have and giving it to the poor. Everything that is sort of lopsided in a various denomination, it's stabilized and it's found in the right balance in the Catholic Church. So, I mean, with everything being in this balance, I mean, I saw so many issues that have plagued different Protestants in various ways normalized. I mean, take the issue of celibacy. You have Jesus saying that there are eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven, but you go to a Reformed church, you're not going to find Pastor Jim who's forsaken marriage for the sake of really serving his people. Then you have some of these odd sects like the Shakers, which takes marriage and puts mandatory celibacy on the people, all of you. So that's just one small issue, but the overall structure of seeing all the things where Christians have sort of gone awry, there's an anchor in the church. And again, with heresies historically as well, when the popes have stopped heresies, it's just been something that, I mean, just seeing even in the 1800s and 1900s with modernism, the way the popes talked about things like in Rerum Novarum and other things, you just see a real interaction with the present issues that the church is facing. And actually also seeing Benedict XVI in my time doing what he's been doing in talking about all the different problems our world is facing, I really found, experienced him as a rock.
I can appreciate that it wasn't just one issue for you. I think most converts would agree with that. There's lots of different reasons, and it's not just that the Catholic Church got this one issue right, and she might not be right on the rest of them. But we open a door and we find that there's it's the Catholic Church really solves all the theological problems that one might have. At least that was the case with me, I think, and that's what I think I'm hearing you say.
Yeah.
Since becoming Catholic, I know for some of my friends it hasn't been a perfect road since then, at least in regards to relationships with other people, and some people have negatively reacted to them, to their conversion. I've been pretty fortunate in that area, but how about you? I know your wife converted along with you.
That's correct, yeah.
What about other friends or family or former pastors or anybody you left behind in the Reformed world? How did they react to your becoming Catholic?
It's very interesting. There have been probably three different types of responses, kind of groups. Some people are completely puzzled. Other people are sort of, they have a way in which they're wishing me well. And then other people are sort of saying that, you know, I've clearly anathematized myself. The puzzled people just think, why would this appeal to you? And this has opened up a lot of interesting conversations. And that's one of the things that I'm really excited about this website, Call to Communion, is some people have that element of just saying, why would anyone want to be interested in being Catholic? And I think that some articles that we'll be posting will try to address that. Mm-hmm. And for those who wish us well are sort of thinking, you know, well, Catholicism's not exactly the best kind of Christianity, but, you know, I think in my heart you're a good believer and you can help some of these apathetic American Christians, you know, and American Catholics. And I think, yeah, that's true, but I mean, it doesn't touch the claims. And so with those people, I think, you know, maybe we can also try to reach them by just making them see the differences clearly. And then lastly, those who have sort of said, you know, these are more of the, I don't want to say everybody in the OPC, but more of the OPC style friends I've had. They basically adopt the notion that what I've done in becoming Catholic is just proven that I never understood Reformed theology. And I think that's the other great thing about Call to Communion is that we want to show, not that, you know, I've been talking about deficiencies of Reformed theology, but there are great things about Reformed theology that I could have spent time talking about too. The greatness of the covenant, the greatness of Christ as having established a kingdom, which I think is best expressed in things like City of God by St. Augustine, and the seriousness of liturgy and worship, and the connection to history. And this, I think it'll be interesting to really talk about how various flavors of Reformed communities have gotten close to saying things that sound kind of Catholic and have gotten punished for it. Particularly, I think of the Federal Vision movement. And so, with those people who think that I never understood it or we never understood it, I think, you know, when we show them that there are actually good things about what Calvin said about the nature of Christ's atonement, etc., then they'll see that not only did we understand it, but we're sort of challenging the standard interpretation, the logical conclusions of those things. And that's why I mentioned the spirit and forms of Protestantism is very influential, because Louis Bouillet does not simply say, this is wrong with Protestantism, that's wrong with Protestantism. He actually discusses how, though it's a protest, there are positive principles undergirding it, such as the supremacy of arguing through Scripture, the sovereignty of God, the believer's responsibility to go to Christ, the importance of grace, that grace, sola gratia, is not a Reformed-only principle, that it's actually there in the most truth in Catholicism. And that sounds impossible to the average Reformed person, but we want to show that that's not only possible, but that that's true. I look forward to this, you know, individual interaction and this sort of corporate interaction on Call to Communion to really come out and show what's so amazingly beautiful about the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I think you brought up some good points, and I share your enthusiasm about this endeavor, Call to Communion. I think a lot of people in the Reformed movement have had similar responses to me and also to other converts that I know, that, well, here's clearly an individual who's at least thinking about theology, and somehow he's come to the conclusion that Rome is right and Geneva is wrong. Well, the only real way I can come to grips with this is that he doesn't really understand what Reformed theology is. Because how could you think it's wrong if you really understood it? So that's interesting. Well, I think that you've got a lot of great points, and I guess that's the conclusion of this interview and therefore the podcast. So thank you for sharing your story with us, and we look forward to interacting with you and the others on Call to Communion. And the podcast, just for any listeners out there, the podcast format is certainly not set in stone. We may very well have some more interviews in the future, and we may have other topics. So we'll just play it by ear and see how it goes.
Thanks for taking the time to talk to me, and I hope that everything I said that makes sense and is edifying, enjoy it. And everything that sounds a little muddled, I didn't really say it. That was somebody else in this room.
All right. Well, all right. God bless. This has been a Called to Communion podcast. Visit us on the web at www.calledtocommunion.com.